We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Simon.
And tonight we're doing another sort of follow-up oddball episode. Tonight we're looking at 1973's TV movie, The Night Strangler, starring Darren McGavin as Carl Kolchak. Seattle, 1973, and a string of bizarre murders kicks off. Tony Vincenzo, now managing editor at the Daily Chronicle, encounters his old colleague, Carl Kolchak, now down on his luck. Vincenzo gives him a job and assigns him to the first murder. As the murders begin to pile up, Kolchak begins to notice some grisly similarities between them. It appears that all the victims were killed by an incredibly strong man who crushed their necks and then extracted a small amount of blood using a syringe from the base of their skull. Traces of rotting flesh found on the victims' throats, and an eyewitness describing the killer as a rotting corpse, clue Kolchak into something supernatural. Could it be happening again? A researcher at the Chronicle discovers a nearly identical series of murders 21 years earlier, and once on the story, further research reveals more murders every 21 years back to 1889. With a sketch artist's impression of the eyewitness's description and the research at hand, Vincenzo prints the story, which leads everyone, especially Kolchak, into hot water. Kolchak suspects that the killer is tied to the Seattle underground city, but cannot find anything. As Kolchak fights Vincenzo and the owner of the paper and the police to get the story, the murders continue. Kolchak spots the uncanny resemblance between Dr. Richard Malcolm, a Civil War doctor who, according to Mark Twain, expounded upon the possibility of the alchemist's dream of the elixir of life, and Dr. Malcolm Richards, the founder of a clinic standing, coincidentally, on the ruins of the hospital Dr. Richard Malcolm was on staff at. Could Malcolm have discovered the elixir of life and still be alive and killing today? Following Malcolm's history back, he came from New York, where, 21 years prior to the earliest Seattle murders, another identical series of murders occurred. The police fail to prevent the sixth and final killing, the event that will mark Malcolm disappearing for another 21 years, so Kolchak, desperate to get the story, explores a previously unknown part of the underground city underneath the clinic. Here he finds Malcolm, both quite chatty about his accomplishment and quite insane. He tells Kolchak how his elixir only lasts 21 years, and new batches require 6 doses, which contain, amongst other things, a small amount of blood drawn within 7 seconds of the death from the brain of a woman. Malcolm prepares to take the 6th and final dose before killing Kolchak, which is a bad move. Kolchak destroys the elixir, and as Malcolm tries to kill him, he begins to age. The police arrive, and Malcolm kills himself. With all Kolchak's research confirmed, the killer found, and the police as witnesses, Kolchak can have his story printed. Right? Except he's fired and run out of town, along with Vincenzo. Together, as the usual. Two head for New York. So, in the early 1970s, as we mentioned, I think it was 72, The Night Stalker came out, and it was a massive, massive ratings hit, a surprise hit, and then, like today, that can only mean one thing.
Sequel!
And here it is, Richard Matheson back again, writing another adventure for Carl Kolchak. I'll let you go first. How did it compare to the first one? How did it, what'd you think?
It compared to the first one in the sense there are very few differences. It's one of those kind of sequels from the let's make the exact same film again school of sequel making, where, I mean, I guess you always have to decide about how much of what made the first successful you want to include just to keep the audience happy. But also to do something new, except they don't seem to have been that interested in the latter at all. You know, I think probably looking at this with the lens of knowing there is a TV series to come and knowing that a TV series needs to be sustained by putting out an episode every week, you kind of expect a formula to be there, which is kind of what the audience come back for and what the audience like. But I think to call this a formula would be a bit generous, because it's basically, apart from translating the city and for some reason taking the same idiot editor there, it's got all the rest of the, you know, he's fighting the same idiot policeman, getting his story not published, you know, remarkably similar supernatural thing to investigate, because you have this unknown man with a history. Okay, so, you know, a long-lived human or near human to investigate. Yeah, essentially, it's pretty much the same film again, but without the benefit of originality. So I was kind of bored by it, to be honest.
So I'm gonna just say that at the time they did make this, they were not thinking TV series.
No, indeed. I understand that's my perception rather than, right, than theirs. But I think even if you look at it as a regular sequel, it's sailing remarkably close to you could just have put on a repeat here.
No arguments. No arguments from me on that one. I would be fascinated to know what the third movie, which was never made, The Night Killers, I believe, would have been like.
Well, I'm not sure I'd have been fascinated, because my assumption is it would be the same film as the other two, but in New York.
I have this, I don't know where I got it, but I have this feeling that The Night Killers was vampires again. So
yeah,
that would be potentially even worse, except obviously there's the twist of there being more than one. But I don't know, because as far as I can tell, there's no drafts or anything out there for that. Well, I don't know if even he got to a draft stage or what before the network picked it up and said, "Now let's run with a TV series." So, you know, I come at this from having watched The Night Stalker, the TV series, Kolchak The Night Stalker. There is a difference in the name, which I don't know, 74, 75, a little bit further on, and never having seen the movies to begin with. So I saw the TV series, and that was in that dark time when you didn't have videotape rental and you didn't have reruns, and who knows, I might not have been able to allow to have been watched it even if it had been reshown on television. So it was many years later before I saw The Night Stalker. And I saw it, and, you know, having come at that after having seen the series, I was already familiar with the characters and the attitudes, and so, you know, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the film, but it wasn't a breath of fresh air for me, because it was familiar, the original. Then I found out about The Night Strangler, and like, what? There's another? That's awesome. And I found it and I watched it, and my reaction was pretty much like yours. I was remarkably disappointed in how identical the story was. And I was also very disappointed that, frankly, you know, Oscar Goldman from The $6 Million Man as a Civil War guy there at the end was not nearly as cool as a vampire. I was disappointed by the fact that it's just some guy that's come up with a formula. And I don't know, it just didn't grab me. It didn't grab me at any level when I watched this movie the first time. And, you know, watching it this time with a sort of critical eye and having just watched The Night Stalker beforehand, not only was I kind of disappointed with the lack of originality, but, you know, they turned some of it up to 11, too.
Yeah.
Like the shouting between Vincenzo and Kolchak.
Oh God, I've got all sorts of notes about the shouting. Throughout my notes, it just says lots of shouting.
That is lots and lots of loud shouting, and it is loud shouting. I mean,
it's like season 19 of Doctor Who, and no one appears to like Kolchak. Everyone's bickering with him, and you kind of wonder, well, why should anyone like him?
I don't know. I do kind of feel like this story does continue to portray Kolchak as, if not an obnoxious person, he is still a competent reporter. He's an incompetent investigator or criminal trapper, but he is, he'll do anything to get that story, and he does get his story. There's problems.
One of the problems is none of the other characters are terribly. I mean, they all just shout. It's like the J.W. Pepper School of Acting, really.
Will our listeners get that reference to Sheriff Pepper from Live and Let Die and Man with a Golden Gun? But look him up. He's a hoot.
Well, yes, he has that that benefit. But the performances in this, there's very little subtlety there, and there's very little reason to be sympathetic to all the shouty men either. So,
right,
it doesn't make for compelling, engaging watching. I don't feel.
Yeah, and I think I said this last time, but it bears repeating. When I watched the TV series of Night Stalker, one of the things that I knew was my dad really hated Kolchak, the character.
Yeah.
He just did not stand the guy. He liked Darren McGavin, the actor, from other things, but, man, he did not like Kolchak at all. And I was oblivious to it. When I'd watch the show, I was like, yeah, get that story. And yeah, it's like, but no, I can see it. I can totally see it now. It's like, he is just an unpleasant person to be around. And why somebody like Joanne Flug, or Louise Harper in this case would want to hang out with him is just boggles my mind.
Hmm.
I mean, yes, okay, she's a belly dancer, so she's, but then she's trying to get her degree. So that character is a weird character to me. I kind of, in the previous movie, Kolchak's girlfriend was, if not a prostitute, then she was certainly someone in the hostessing and industry of some kind. She was not a high class, educated person. And
well, I wouldn't say those are mutually exclusive.
No.
She was educated. She was getting a degree.
In this one, yes. Louise.
Oh, yes.
But not
sorry,
in the I'm, first one. The girlfriend from
I'm
Vegas, she
up.
Was kind of, Kolchak's not a particularly likable person, and he's kind of seedy and down on it. So it kind of matched. But here, he's just punching so far above his weight, and yet she works in a pretty seedy profession. Belly dancer at a place like that is 1970s metaphor for stripper.
Uh-huh.
Which, of course, they just couldn't do on TV, so...
Too shocking.
Too shocking. But here you have one who is not only very attractive, but she's also a psychology student, almost getting her degree. It really seems kind of a weird pairing to me. It just didn't work. And after I wrote my synopsis of this, I noticed that I didn't even mention her.
Oh,
not well, didn't even cross my mind. And I get to the end of it and I look back and I go, oh yeah. And there's his sort of girlfriend throughout it. She, sort of played an important part at the end, but for the most part, it's almost like the line where Kolchak says, I invited her to go along on the tour for part of my research, but to tell you the truth, it's not because she was helping me with my research. It's like, yeah, because he just likes having her around. So, and fair dues there. But
And that's pretty much, you know, the role of both of them, it seems to me. They haven't been given any actual anything to do.
Mm-hmm. They're just there to prove that somebody could like Kolchak, I suppose.
Yeah.
Speaking of shocking... Shocked, I say. I was very surprised that in a 1973 production, what was her name? Charisma Beauty and her obviously lesbian husband were in this show. I'm shocked. I'm shocked in an American TV show that they so obviously had a lesbian couple. That, I mean, okay, pretty stereotype, way over the top, but that just surprised the heck out of me. Homosexual people were not generally portrayed in television unless they were, you know, Mr. Humphreys from Are You Being Served kind of characters. And in my mind, I kind of remember from watching it a long time ago that Charisma Beauty, the incredibly stupid dancer, had a weird boyfriend. that was my mind had that character as a man. And then he shows up and it's like, oh, missed that the first time through. And the fact that Kolchak even calls her husband is just shocked the heck out of me. But they got away with that back then.
That's not calling her husband in quite the same respectful way it would be now.
Oh no! Oh no! 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 It was definitely a dig. No doubt about it. But and come on, Wilma Krankheimer. Wow, that was Yeah, it was not a good thing. I mean, it was... it surprised me that it was there, but then it was a pretty nasty way of doing it, too. So, and it didn't really have the slightest bearing on the story, as far as I can tell.
No, I mean, I guess my feeling is there's no particular reason why it should have anything to bear on the story. But on the other hand, I'm inclined to agree with you. It's not done nicely.
No.
So,
here's another area copying right out the music. I don't think they wrote a note of new music for this story.
Well, why bother?
Yeah, it's like well, let's get this one done on the cheap. Those were things. Let's see what else. My notes are in a disarrayed order here. So,
what I would say. Coming back to your point about the plot disappointing you the first time round, you saw this with, you know, it just turning out to be some old man.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have a problem with the plot per se. I think this is the kind of thing that I can think of a number of equivalents, again, in the X-Files, where they did it, but did it well. So there's potential there, I think. You know, things of patterns of murders that are periodic and something that is not quite human, at least not human anymore, really, coming out and preying on people at intervals, and there being an urgency about catching him because of the hibernation period and all that kind of stuff. That all seems very familiar as an X-Files viewer, and to work well, it's purely the execution, really. It's purely the Kolchak going around being unlikable, and all the people shouting at him, it's not just the confrontation in the performances. It's actually in the script. There's no kind of subtlety to the way that's drawn out, because Kolchak basically just has massive leaps of intuition in order to get where it is. It doesn't seem to be based on a lot of evidence or experience, though I suppose you can now chalk up the night, whatever the first one was called, Stalker?
Yeah.
Stalker, yeah. As being something that he has now as reference.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, he's there making these huge leaps of intuition. Meanwhile, everyone else, the police and Vincenzo and all the rest, are just basically denying everything. And there's no... what you notice is the absence of there being any real skeptic to whom he has to account in the way that Mulder has Scully. That it, skepticism is not the same as just kind of going, no, that's wrong, and all the kind of denials that you get through this. To which, anyway, he doesn't respond in any kind of way that is persuasive or attempting to explain himself. He just says, oh, you're wrong, I'm right.
And he is... So a couple things. You mentioned, you know, the stupid editor back, and I like Simon Oakland, the actor. He's been in tons of things in the United States over the years. I'm sure he's no longer with us, but he detracts from this story, in my opinion, because he should be more open to it after the events in Las Vegas. If it were any other editor, then you could expect them to be reset to ground one. And as you say, you could kind of... Kolchak is past the supernatural can't happen phase. He's like, once that's been proved, and to his mind, it has been proved to him, then he can make that... He can kind of make that leap without having to go through his own internal skepticism, if you will. Because you could
understand his motivation better.
He thought in the first one, when they started giving the, you know, teeth, saliva, blood drawn, that his first thought was, it's a guy who thinks he's a vampire, mm-hmm. not it's a vampire. But here, he almost jumps immediately to, it's a rotting flesh. It's a rotting corpse. Which, you know, I suppose you probably would be a little more open to it the second time around. Which does lead me to probably my biggest complaint about the X-Files, is that Scully remains skeptical too long. She has these bouts where she believes it and she sees it with her own eyes, and then it's very easy for her to be talked out of it by somebody who comes along and says, oh, no, those weren't aliens. Those were victims of a special disease. Oh, see, Mulder, it's not aliens. And
being skeptical isn't the same as denying it. So the fact that Scully changes her mind is that's because she's skeptical. The difference is that at the start she doesn't believe it, and then some things come along, and so she has to accept the evidence there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same as, you know, Vincenzo in this case in the first one completely disbelieving it, but then the evidence comes along and then he should accept it. And that's not a question of having a skeptical mind, if you like. It's just a question of there's been a tipping point. Anyone would have to accept what they'd seen when they'd seen what he had seen.
So, although Vincenzo never actually saw the vampire, so...
No, maybe, but he did... Well, okay, so maybe...
He did see the fallout of everything that happened, and...
Maybe someone could hang on to their denial through all of that, but the point is he didn't, so he ended up... I don't know, there seemed to me a potential for it to be quite interesting when in the very, very opening shots of this one, we turn out to be following Vincenzo, because... That could be a new approach. I mean, for one thing, it could be Vincenzo comes across something that is unusual and verging on the supernatural, and so he calls in Kolchak because he knows him to be someone who understands or at least has a bit of experience of these things.
That's actually good. That's good. That would be a good twist.
Well,
it'd be
better than the pure coincidence. I mean, I quite liked the fact that Kolchak was sitting in that bar like the Ancient Mariner, and it was like he was the Ancient Mariner, and he stoppeth one in three.
Mm-hmm.
to talk about vampires because he hasn't got a job, he hasn't got a girlfriend, he doesn't know anyone in the city. He just has this story like an albatross around his neck, and all he is doing is sitting there boring drinkers in this bar.
Mm-hmm.
None of that lasted. It all just went straight into a reset, and Vincenzo went back to the kind of standard role. So it almost felt like they had just written another editor, just like they'd written another bunch of thick-headed policemen,
mm-hmm.
and then they'd happen to cast the same guy in it again.
Something to be said there. I guess maybe they thought they had great chemistry when they were shouting at each other.
Well, it was more interesting the first time round.
Kolchak has a great line when he's sitting there in the bar. I may not have gotten it exactly right, but he's yelling at that guy that's sitting in the booth, and he says, "What does it matter if it doesn't make sense? These are the facts."
Yeah.
It does kind of sum him up at that stage, how he's looking at it. Does it have to make sense? I mean, if you've collected the data point and the data is not assailable, let's say, or is unassailable, I should say. Not assailable. Yeah, either way. It's kind of... the other thing. With regards to his adversarial attitude with Vincenzo, it was more than just shouting at each other or trying to convince him. He would come in... He was taunting him with those stories. He wasn't trying to say, "Hey, Tony, you gotta. I've got to convince you of this." He'd be like, "Here's the paper. Why don't you just read that? And I'll just sit here and be smug on the sofa for a little while." You know, almost like he was trying to bait him.
How to win friends and influence people.
Yeah, not being the nicest of guys.
So I've got one thing that I did think was different and I quite liked in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Seattle.
Yes.
I mean, the whole underground city
real
stuff
thing.
was quite interesting. That was a nice diversion. I don't quite know who lit all those flipping candles.
So,
and God, so much dry ice. So much dry ice.
James walked into the room and he says, "What's with the fog machine?" the thing is, and I've been to Seattle, and I did not know about the underground city when I was there, and so I've never seen it. I have seen I did a little bit of search. I didn't get enough time to really go in depth, but it is a real thing. But it looks more like what we saw on the tour at the beginning.
Yes.
And it does not look anything at all like five-story Victorian buildings complete with dead grass and carriages just left scattered about and fog rolling in and gas lamps lit all over the place.
Yeah. It looked good. I mean, it's nice to imagine those are the bits that are off the kind of tourist beaten track obviously otherwise... Yeah, there'd be people in there nicking the wheels off the carriages or whatever.
Yeah, all that amazing antiques that would be worth good money.
yeah. But if you sat down and kind of worked out how long it would take to fuel and light all of those gas lamps, if you are one person, you think, my God, no wonder he needs eternal life.
Mm-hmm. And he's insane.
Yeah. So would you trust him with matches?
No. And then that Victrola did seem to be sort of electric.
Oh, yeah.
It's like I was... When Kolchak flipped that switch, I'm like, I'm not actually sure how old-timey record
Maybe
players
got...
work, but I thought you cranked them up and a spring ran them. But maybe you can switch the spring off. I don't know. But, yeah, that was weird. That part probably fails me... the most. I mean, we have had a relatively, I don't want to say mundane, but there's some real tension in some of the scenes, and there is, danger and atmosphere in Seattle, and then they go down into that underground city, and it's just so absurd that it's like, that's awesome, But come on, not only is it, but I counted it. There are definitely 5-story buildings there. But then Kolchak goes in on the ground floor of one, and he goes down at least 2 more floors before he gets to Malcolm's dinner table with his mummified family posed at the dinner table. Was that? Is that from, like, Great Expectations? Is that the Dickens novel with the...
Yes. Yes, Miss Havisham's house.
Were there bodies?
No bodies. Just the wedding banquet.
That was my thought. But, yeah, they're all posed. And then he's sitting there eating. He eats at that table with the rats crawling all over it. It's
very OTT, but at that point, it's not like there's anything in the... in the story that I'm thinking, oh, God, this has kind of ruined the great story.
Not ruined it, but I mean, it does kind of like, it threw me. It kind of threw me out of it. I was like, okay, that's why does nobody know that? How do the buildings on top of that not fall through?
Yeah.
And, you know, when they built the city over the top of it, it's not like when they built it, they didn't know it was down there. They had to build pillars and stuff to hold up the upper level. I believe the reason they built it on top was because, as he even kind of mentions in the tour, the tide would bring the sewers up, and so that kind of low lying area was not particularly pleasant anyway. And so they just raised it all up higher and rebuilt on top. But 5 stories. And no, 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 no. It's not. I cool, but darn. No, I guess I was disappointed in it because it's Oscar Goldman from the $6 Million Man. You know, we go through the whole thing and we're told this is a rotting corpse, and we get the artist's rendition of him, and we get the stories of how he's, and it's supposed to be this supernatural, super strong killer. But by the time we see him, he's all healed up and looking good, and he's just an actor I've seen in a million things, and usually is a good guy. And it's kind of like that was part of the letdown, I think, for me. Anyway, there were many, many things. Okay, so. Question. Well, not question. First observation. Guest stars. Now, I was curious. Did you recognize any of the people? Did any of the names mean anything to you?
No.
No. Okay. So, like Mr. Fassbender. That's David Carradine. He used to play Dracula in Universal horror films after Bela Lugosi left. Oh,
I wouldn't have seen those, but the name rings a bell. What else has he done?
Well, you may know his son.
Let's
see. He's David. Was he David Carradine? No, that was John Carradine. I'm sorry. That was John Carradine that we just watched. David Carradine is his son who was a star of Kung Fu and some others, which is a popular series that I'm sure never made it to Britain.
No, I haven't seen that either. Never mind.
That was our TV series of shame in the United States where Bruce Lee came up with this concept for a TV series about a Chinese Shaolin priest traveling the U.S. West because he's a wanted man, you know, helping people, solving problems using Kung Fu. And they said, wow, that is a fantastic idea. And then they didn't hire Bruce Lee to do it. They hired a white guy and put him in.
Ooh.
Yeah. And it was a very popular show for many
years. That, just the levels of both stupid and offensive there. Mm-hmm.
And they didn't do enough to David Carradine to make him even look remotely Asian. But he looks kind of like...
But they could have had
there,
Bruce so. Lee, for God's sake.
Yes! That was the whole point.
Even forgetting the kind of whole... how just terribly, terribly offensive it is to use a white actor in the role. I mean, Bruce Lee, for goodness sake.
Bruce Lee, yeah. Yeah, it was a dark hour to, but neither here. John Carradine, Wally Cox was the Mr. Barry, the researcher, and
yeah, who could, you know, he could have been more of a Scully skeptic, but actually, he ended up being more of a kind of egging Kolchak on rather than...
He was helping him out. He was, amongst other things, the voice of Underdog, but he also used to do a lot of the same kinds of films that, like, Don Knotts would do. Sort of this meekish... You know, again, a name that Americans would know in 1970s at the time. Margaret Hamilton, that was the Miss Crabwell, the expert on the Elixir of Life. That's the Wicked Witch of the West from The Wizard of Oz.
Oh.
And, let's see. Oh, and Al Lewis, the bum. That's Grandpa Munster from The Munsters. it was just an odd collection of actors. And the guy playing the cop, Scott Brady, I know I've seen him in a million things, but I couldn't tell you what he was known for. But yeah, it's like, okay, they got people that people would know in that day and age to do the parts, and they're really just kind of bit parts. Kind of a strange thing. Although Miss Crabwell does have that great line, if the Elixir of Life exists, I'd be an 80-year-old sex pot. Like, no, you wouldn't. never happening.
The internet has told me where David Carradine is a familiar name from. He was Kill Bill. He was Bill.
Oh, yeah. He was Kill Bill. That's right. And he got that part because he played Kwai Chan Kane in Kung Fu.
Right, yes.
Yeah. Who was supposed to be half white, and that's why they could let a white guy play, supposedly. I'm just saying. You know, my daughter could play. My daughter could play either. So, you know, it does happen. Anyway. So, Malcolm is immortal-ish every 21 years. He's super strong. They still pumped him full of bullets. Or they appeared to pump him full of bullets. Is he supposed to be that kind of immortal? Or is he just long-lived immortal? Because he does jump to his death at the end.
Yes, but after he hasn't had his medicine, isn't it? I mean...
Yeah.
The problem seems to be not having the medicine. I mean, as ever, we don't really get enough about how this actually works. It's not even the mechanism of how it achieves what it does, but actually... clarity about what it does, because I would have thought, like you, it would simply hold back age.
Yeah.
So it would stop one thing from killing you, which is nature, but it wouldn't stop anything else from killing you, which is being shot a lot of times or jumping off
the
something.
Brain. Yeah. Yeah.
But actually, the kind of the instant aging that occurred when he missed his dose.
Yeah, that
struck me. That, it was obviously done for dramatic purposes, but I thought, oh, blimey, you're cutting it a bit fine with timing the elixir. You know, you got 21 years to get this thing in, and actually, you know, it's 8:15, you're going to age to death, and you're not going to take it till 8:14 or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And that's... Okay. Gosh, this story doesn't make sense. I'll preface this comment with that. How did he figure that out in the first place? I mean, was there more than just 6 doses in 18 days? Did there have to be one dose, then another dose 2 days later, then another dose 4 days later, and then 2 final doses? I mean, how do you get that right the first time in 1878 or whatever it was, or 68 in New York? When he first developed this elixir, how did he work out that schedule to, I got to do this exactly right, and then he recreates it every... Because it doesn't appear to be any room for error.
No.
Right? No. He's like, it turns out if I wait 1 minute longer than this, I'm going to die.
Extensive clinical trials and presumably multiple control groups.
Also, within 7 seconds of death, the blood from the brain.
Yes. Oh, but you know what was even better than that?
I tried 8 seconds and it didn't work.
Yeah, but what was even better? Well, I'm sure, you know, took several bits of blood from not near enough the brain or 8 seconds too late. What was even better than that nonsense was, and I may be doing a terrible disservice here, but the pathologist... Mm-hmm. was able to give he noticed
yes.
there was 6 or 7 cc's of blood missing.
Yes, yes.
So I don't know in metric exactly how much blood one has, but surely there's some variation. I mean, you can't kind of look at someone and go, well, there should be however many cc's of blood in this person, and then you measure it and you go, oh, yep, 6 cc's short. Someone must have sucked it out from the base of his skull.
Yes, I agree. I have that marked down.
And you don't, why do you even look for that? Is that routine? You measure everyone's blood, check it off against how much there should be, go, yep, it's all here.
Yeah, there are 5.5 liters of blood in the human body.
Okay, so...
So 6 or 7 cc's is literally a drop in a very large bucket.
Yeah, it's what, less than 0.1%? So slightly more than 0.1%, but still.
5,600 cc's, roughly.
We're talking about really a very, very, very small variation.
Mm-hmm.
See, it seems implausible that humans are quite as regular as content.
What happens is when they go into the pathologist, they drain all the blood and they measure it. And then they compare it to their medical records from when they were alive, how much blood they had then. Because we all have our blood measured here in the United States. I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. I need to go and get my blood measured. Yeah. I wouldn't like to be running short, you know.
It's not just that. That's 1973. They noted it in the news articles from 1952, too. That there was a small quantity of blood missing. Like,
well, it's always been very hot on blood measuring, I'm sure. It's one of the first
Seattle
developments.
Yeah. So that one was a weird one. And here's my next question. So if you have to take it within 7 seconds of them dying, that would imply that there's some sort of vitality that fades after 7 seconds. Although I'm not sure what he does with it after he takes it out of their body to preserve it at that 7 second moment. But would the blood of a live woman work? Because I think you could take 6 or 7 cc's out of a person and still let them live.
Yeah, well, it certainly seems unnecessary to... well, it might be helpful to render them unconscious because they might object to the procedure. But whether you need to kill them or not. But no doubt, you know, extensive testing has taken place to verify that, yes, they needed to be dead, but for no more than 7 seconds, in much the same way as the dose had to be administered at precisely 8:14 or whatever.
Yes, those problems didn't interject themselves in my mind as I'm watching through it this time going, yeah, okay. We can have some fun with this, I suppose, but I did like that the police weren't actually stupid in this one. I think we discussed it last time that maybe the police had come around to thinking it was a vampire before Kolchak sat down and gave them the spiel. But in this one, even though the cop was a shouty cop, they had done the research. They'd done more research than Kolchak had. Now, we don't know if it wasn't, you know, before or after they printed that article, but I mean, they went back and checked the records on the crimes going back 21 years. They went back and checked the eyewitness descriptions. They searched the underground. They did all the things that Kolchak thought he was the only guy doing, but they came to a different conclusion. They did not come to the, well, he has to be there. He's some sort of a rotting flesh killer. I mean,
which is understandable.
Yeah. So I appreciated that I don't like it. I don't like it that they would just be completely stupid because they're not going to be completely stupid and be running the police department. They may be horrifically corrupt or perhaps even incompetent, but not completely stupid. And so I was pleased. And the fact that they knew the word vituperation, which... That scene was so natural. I mean, if there was anything that happened to that, it's Kolchak is being a jerk to the cop for using, you know, a word that is probably would be considered a little bit more of a highbrow word, but he's a bit of a jerk to him about it. But the cop's reaction is perfect. I mean, this is what happens a lot of times when somebody uses an uncommon word and somebody else questions on it. You don't immediately defend yourself. You immediately think, well, did I get that wrong? What did I say? And that one thing I was like, okay, see that? That was like the moment when this cop was a human and not just a shouty guy staring as an adversary to Kolchak. But it was enough that I put it in my notes. I liked it. But let's see. What else have I got? Nothing. I don't know. Oh, we do have the scene where Kolchak is shouting. Well, shock there. Vincenzo saying, you need to get onto Fassbender. You need to get onto the police. And you need to force them into doing what I want them to do. That sort of all the megalomania came out right there in that moment.
That's Kolchak.
Yeah. Up to that point, I felt like Kolchak has always been after the story. But in that moment, I felt like Kolchak was after vindication. Which, yeah, after the events in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
After this, I can see that. I could see that flaw, but it just wasn't... It just kind of popped out of nowhere, and right that Vincenzo called him on it, but really we don't go anywhere with it. It's just then it goes back to the way he was all along. Wow, wasn't the world weird before they had Google, though?
It was. I remember it.
Well, yes, so do I, but I can remember they didn't do it in this one, but I think I saw it in an X-Files episode recently, so... You know, and that's even world before Google, which is terrifying. You know, here they're using the actual paper archives of the morgue at the newspaper, but also the old microfiche machines with the the newspapers being in reverse.
I used to love those.
I spent a lot of time down at the library going through old papers and just looking at stuff. It's a weird thing. I'll recount a story, and it's kind of intentional, but kind of an accident. When I was going through papers, I ran across the news article from when I was three, when my mother was killed in a car accident. And,
you weren't looking for it.
I was kind of in that right zone. And I was looking through Tucson newspapers at the time, but no, I was looking for something. I was looking for something else, and I don't remember what it was. It was probably something entertainment related. Like I was looking for movies. I would go through and look at the movie pages, you know, the movie times, and what was showing and stuff like that. And I was in that zone, but I didn't know exactly what day that she died on and what day it was in the paper, and I came across it just kind of skimming through because I think it wasn't necessarily on the front page, or it may have been. But, you know, it's a small town. So it wasn't the headline or anything, but it was interesting because, you know, I had only ever heard of that incident from my dad or from my grandparents telling me in sort of an abstract way. And then, you come across this thing and you actually read what a reporter dug up on it and wrote. And, you know, it was nothing. It was an accident. You know, if somebody ran a red light, it was an accident. But seeing it there from that completely third party, cold perspective, you know, nobody sees that's a mom with a 3-year-old kid who'll never see his mom again or, you know, nothing like that. And there's no context for it. Looking through his old papers. So I found that strangely compelling when, you know, Mr. Barry's character is going through these things and pulling up these crimes and you're sort of reading them and taking yourself back into that kind of, that's what I get out of that that sequence there is that's an interesting way to go through and find info on the crime and also to learn about the past through newspapers as opposed to history books. You know, what it said at the time as opposed to what we say now.
Yes, yes.
So that sequence, and this is vaguely spoilery, but I doubt this is a problem we'll have to worry about. But this whole sequence with Mr. Barry was almost lifted, not quite the same crime, but lifted almost word for word for the Kolchak revival TV series in one of the episodes. So I happened to be watching through those shortly after watching the first run through on the Night Strangler, and I happened to hit that episode, and I'm like, wow, this is, they just, I think in some places, line for line, lifted the dialogue out and plunked it down in the 1990s version of this, the Frank Spotnitz series. When he left the X-Files, he went off to make a remake of the Night Stalker series. And so his homage to the original was there. Because that was definitely more an X-Files type series. But they did have this thing where they were going back, finding this recurring event in the past at the newspaper. Anyway. But that's neither here nor there. All right. Anything else?
Well, only that the internet tells me that the Night Killers, had it occurred, would have been set in Hawaii.
Oh, really?
And would have involved a mysterious UFO and people being replaced by androids. So,
really?
There seems to be quite a lot of a script on DarrenMcGavin.net. So
I missed that, Darren.
That might be, you could stick the link in the show notes for the hardcore Kolchak fans. That might be worth having a look at. Certainly the plot sounds a lot more interesting and different than the first two films.
Yeah, that's, aw, look at him there. He's with, who's he with there? Yeah. Wow, he was young once. Look at him there in Riverboat. That was a long time ago. All right. Well, that's, I'm going to have to look that one up. I'll have to read whatever parts of the script are there. Cause yeah, that does sound completely different. I think honestly, Richard Matheson is a good writer. He's done a lot of good stuff here. This was not his finest hour in terms of story or in terms of originality. He really too on the nose with this sequel. So yeah, maybe he got some criticism from it. Like, you know, Dick, good, but hey, same story. Let's not do that again. And maybe he went off and did something else. That would be cool. Yeah, you don't want to read too much about it. You might find out about the series, and that would be, you know,
I'll save it for when I've watched it.
Okay. Well, in that case, Simon, thank you.
A pleasure, as always.
Joining me. And listeners, I hope you've enjoyed our little detour through the Kolchak Night Stalker Strangler movies. And I do hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us? Please consider becoming our sponsor at patreon.com/fusionpatrol. We'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on iTunes. Stop by and visit us at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Search for us on Facebook under Fusion Patrol. Check out our Twitter handle, @FusionPatrol. Or just send us an email at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Please come join the conversation. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.